We now turn to the subject of bioethical issues and the practice of medicine during the medieval period. And I've used the term a medieval period in a rather loose way here, because in our latter discussions in this section, when we look at debates concerning animation and what I've termed obstetrical abortion, we will also be looking at writers who actually lived during the period that we call the Renaissance. But nevertheless, we're going to begin with medical care primarily in the Christian West during the period that has sometimes been referred to as the Dark Ages, dark in the sense that we don't have a lot of documentation for this period. And that's roughly from the fall of authority in the West, beginning in the early 5th century, up to the time of the beginnings of the consolidation of the Western Empire under Charlemagne in the year 800. And during this period, medical care was very often to be found in the monasteries. As we'll see, and I've given you at the very beginning of this lecture a little picture at the very beginning which shows Constantinus Africanus, who was a Benedictine monk of the Abbey of Monte Cassino, the abbey originally founded by Saint Benedict, who was very instrumental in the later Middle Ages in translating texts from Arabic into Latin and making available the ancient texts by Hippocrates and Galen that had been preserved in the Muslim world, although parenthetically, we might wish to know that the original translations of these texts were done by Christians, Christians who spoke both Syriac and Arabic and who were also familiar with with Greek. Constantinus Africanus was one of those who promoted the retranslation into Latin of these texts as they became available through contact with the Muslim world in the High Middle Ages. But he's a reminder, and there he is with his Benedictine habit, consulting or being consulted by a number of people who are showing him flasks of urine and asking him to assess their various diseases. Uroscopy was a very popular method of diagnosis in the Middle Ages, even though, as we know today, there are only a very limited number of diseases that you can assess based on examination, based on visual examination of the urine. However, it was very popular in the Middle Ages because it didn't cause any pain on the part of the patients being examined. We'll see that Constantinus, as a Benedictine monk, is significant because much of the care in the medieval world, again, up until the consolidation of the empire and the rise of the High Middle Ages, was to be found in monasteries and, in particular, in Benedictine monasteries. I have some prejudice in this in that I am a Benedictine monk myself, and I look rather proudly on this period of my order's heritage. In the Rule of Saint Benedict, and if you can drop down to that section, you'll see that there is an entire chapter devoted to the sick brothers. Care of the sick must rank before and above everything. Super omnia, says Saint Benedict, that the sick may be truly served as Christ himself. Sicut revera Christu. Christo serviatur. So there is a sense that in serving the sick, one is directly ministering to the Lord, Christ in the presence of the one who suffers. But Benedict is quite aware of the fact that it is often not easy to take care of the sick. They have many demands. They're not often themselves psychologically. It requires a great deal of patience. And he goes on to say in verse 4, the sick are to consider that they are served out of honor for God. So the sick should remember why they are being served. In other words, they are to see in those who serve them an example of Christ ministering to them. So this is a kind of a bilateral Christology. The one who is ministering to the sick sees Christ in that suffering individual. The one who is sick is encouraged to see Christ in the physician, in this case the monk physician or monk attendant, who is offering some kind of care to that person. A very beautiful example of a kind of mutually contemplative model of healthcare. He goes on to insist that this requires the virtue of patience, he says in verse 5, and that the abbot is responsible for the care of the sick in his community, numbers 6 and 10. The sick are to be given special privileges that wouldn't ordinarily be allowed people who were healthy. They have their own room, they have someone who is responsive, available to them, an attendant. they're allowed to bathe more frequently, and their diets should be that which will encourage health. Namely, they are allowed to eat meat, which was often not the case in most medieval monasteries, at least during the early years of monasticism, not because of the modern approach to vegetarianism, but for the simple reason that meat was the food of the wealthy. It takes a lot more effort and expenditure of resources to create a cow than it does to harvest a field and eat the grain from that field. So St. Benedict provides a model for care that was in fact followed very closely during the Middle Ages. In the monasteries of the Christian West, there were also to be found a strong emphasis on the reception of guests. Guests were to be received as Christ himself. The same kind of language is used. And one finds that in medieval monasteries, there were often apartments for the guests who were sick. So this concern for the health of those who are, as it were, Christ suffering among us was extended not only to the monastic community, but also to those who were received as guests. And during the Crusades, when there seems to have been an outbreak as a result of the returning Crusaders carrying with them the disease, there seems to have been an outbreak of leprosy, a true leprosy, not some virulent skin disease that appeared to be leprosy, but the real thing, imported from the Near East. There were created leprosaria, places where the lepers could be treated, cared for. There was, of course, no cure, but nevertheless where they could be offered compassionate medical ministration. And these were often associated with and even managed by monasteries in the Western Church. There were later orders that were specifically created, one in particular, the Order of St. Lazarus, which was particularly devoted to the care of lepers during the Middle Ages. Well, this monastic emphasis on healthcare, which was mirrored, I should add parenthetically, in the East by the creation of institutions to take care of the sick, which were more under the direction of the bishop. St. Basil the Great is a great institutor of this tradition. The monasteries were expected to fund and even supply the buildings for these, but the monks did not themselves necessarily provide the direct hands-on health care in the Christian East, as they clearly did in the West, where the infirmarian would be specifically charged with this responsibility, both for monks and for guests as well. This monastic emphasis on medieval medical practice was shifted, was modified, if you drop down to number 2-1, at the Second and Fourth Lateran Councils, and we'll look at the text of these and the reasons for them shortly, because the Church began to be concerned that the full-blown practice of medicine, including the practice of bleeding and surgery without anesthesia or antisepsis, the administration of drugs that could have very violent side effects, all of these things were things that it began to be more and more felt should not be associated with the monastic orders or with the clergy in terms of the sources to which people turned for this kind of treatment. And so, as we'll see, the Church introduced reforms that promoted the development of the secular profession of medicine at the same time that the universities began to develop, especially in the 12th century. And in this text introduction to number 2-1, I've pointed out that there were several reasons behind the Church's increasing emphasis that the formal practice of medicine should not be undertaken by the clergy. It had a variety of reasons, which we'll look at in the text themselves. But let's now drop down to the pictures from this Ashmole 1462 manuscript in the Bodleian Library at Oxford, which demonstrates medieval medical care here by a secular physician who can be identified by his red robe. You'll see he has his left hand comforting the patient by placing his hand on the shoulder in a reassuring way, while his right hand is holding a poker in a fire. He is preparing for cautery, which we would today simply call branding, taking a red-hot poker and applying it to the skin. We may ask ourselves, what was this supposed to do for people? It can be regarded as a particularly painful and primitive form of acupuncture. It certainly didn't cure any diseases, but it took the person who had presented with a complaint's mind off their complaint when they went to the physician. If you've been branded on your forehead for having a headache, you certainly stop thinking about the headache and start thinking about other kinds of things. If you drop down to number 212, there's an example of cautery points for headache. You have a what you might call an example of early group therapy with three individuals waiting for the physician who's making sure the fire's quite hot enough for them, and he's got three little irons in the fire for them as well. If you drop down to the pictures mark number 213, this is an illustration of medieval cautery points. There's an example here of the kinds of, and there's a list of the symptoms of what you would expect of someone who had been bitten by a rabid dog. Of course, rabies was untreatable and pretty universally fatal in the Middle Ages. If we drop down now to numbers 214 and the picture below it, this is a picture of the of a treatment of surgery for nasal polyps, and much more perplexing for us, cataract surgery, which consisted in making a little incision to the side of the cornea and popping the lens out. This is astonishing, especially in the for the reason that in some cases it did not induce an infection that destroyed the eye, and there were individuals who were actually able to see afterwards. It was a procedure that was performed with much greater success in the Far East, in India and elsewhere, although it was exported to the West. If we drop down now to number 215, those manuscript illuminations illustrate surgical instruments, rather brutal instruments, primarily used for amputations, and then a herbal, that is to say, a text specifically recommending particular plant products for healing. Lamentably, none of the plants that are listed there actually treat any particular illnesses. And then a very sad reminder in the last little picture from this collection, number 216. These are unfortunately obstetrical instruments, all of them intended for the piecemeal removal of an infant that could not be delivered normally. Let's look now at the texts from the Second and Fourth Lateran Councils that began to regulate the practice of medicine, or at least to restrict the practice of medicine as far as clerics were concerned. The Second Lateran Council in 1139 was particularly concerned with members of religious orders, with monks and canons being those who follow the rule of St. Augustine, either living in a cathedral under the direction of the bishop or as members of a religious order such as the Premonstratensians, the so-called canons regular. This text is particularly concerned with temporal gain. Notice a little bit further down, there's a mention of hateful money. The concern is that these members of religious orders have undertaken the formal study of medicine, and it's also mentioned incidentally that some of them are studying law as well, and then effectively they are charging money for their services. So the concern is that effectively you have members of the clergy, and more specifically members of religious orders, charging for something which had formerly been done as an expression of their compassionate concern for the sick, and as we've seen particularly in the case of Benedictines because of what had been written in the Rule of Saint Benedict. So the restriction on monks and canons doing this, and notice towards the end of this particular text, we forbid by apostolic authority this practice to continue, that is, emphasizing the care of bodies rather than being concerned with the care of souls. Monks and canons are not to practice medicine formally. This did not mean that in the monasteries there would not be monastic physicians and monastic nurses, that is, those who would care in the monasteries for those who were members of those communities. Or even that, as I mentioned earlier, during the High Middle Ages, when you had these leprosaria run by monastics, that they couldn't be manned by monks. Of course they could, but monks could not go out as itinerant physicians and offer their services and charge money for it, and neither could canons. If we drop down now to number 2.3, the text of the Fourth Lateran Council, the concern here is not so much the financial issues associated with the practice of medicine, but in fact the agonizing and bloodletting and even potentially lethal aspects of the practice. It's couched together, this prohibition against the practice of medicine is couched together with not pronouncing a sentence of death. Also, it's a reminder that during this period, in many parts of the Roman Empire, the Christianized Roman Empire, now organized under initially under Constantine and then under the Germanic Ottonians, there was a form of Germanic law that practiced what was called the ordeal in order to demonstrate the truthfulness of what you said. A person would effectively be judiciously tortured. They would be forced to walk across red-hot plowshares or carry a red-hot iron for a specific length of time. And initially, the local governors wanted the clergy to be a part of this, to bless the practice, literally to bless the instruments that were used for these judicial ordeals. And as we can see, this council is very concerned about that. It does not want clerics being involved as judicial figures. They do not want them involved in, as they put it here, burning or cutting. No subdeacon, deacon, or priest shall practice the part of surgery involving burning or cutting, or shall they be involved in judicial tests or ordeals with hot or cold water or hot iron. So the concern here is less the financial issue of the Second Lateran Council, but much more the question of the clergy being involved in something that is itself agonizing and potentially lethal. This should not happen. And so a tradition developed that it was the shedding of blood which was forbidden to clergy. And in fact, if one had practiced a profession such as being a soldier or an executioner or a physician that involved the regular shedding of blood, one needed a dispensation in order to be ordained to the clergy. Let's look now at the texts that we've assembled in section 3, the large red bar that I've described as councils, bishops, and penitentials on abortion and contraception. This assembly of texts is not official church teaching documents per se, but it does give us an indication as to how these questions were being regarded as the penitential discipline of the church developed up until approximately, as we'll see, the 8th century. Then we'll be looking more specifically at the articulation by theologians whose writings will be taken very seriously, and particularly St. Thomas Aquinas. But these collections of particularly the penitentials are documents that were intended to guide confessors in assigning penances to individuals. They were originally based on the very strict penances that had been inherited from the early church and also from the penitential practices of the Irish church. And there were a variety of different approaches, particularly to the question of abortion and contraception, that implied different understandings of the moral significance of that act during this period. And if we look at the introduction to this material, which I've adapted from your textbook, from Jones' Soul of the Embryo in Chapter 5, what I've highlighted in particular is his emphasis on that the documents illustrating and providing different approaches to the understanding of what is happening during gestation and its moral significance. And one finds that there tends to be a distinction between the kinds of penances that were assigned depending on the age of the developing child, the age of the fetus. There was even an unusual approach that he points out in the penitentials that is not so much steeped in the tradition of Aristotle, but in another kind of what might be regarded as a sort of folk observation, a sense that there was an initial stage when the embryo was unformed, a second stage where the embryo was, as it were, recognizably flesh, but was not considered to have a soul, and a third stage at which the developing child, the fetus, was regarded as having been ensouled. Now, there is no consistency in these documents as to exactly when these different periods occur, and as our author points out, it's not an Aristotelian approach, may have been influenced by other kinds of sources, but what it generally implies is that there would be a lesser penance early in gestation and a greater penance later. But, this is very important to note, early abortion was always regarded as a serious sin. The question that we'll see is, there was not uniformity as to whether early abortion was regarded as homicide, as exactly the same kind of crime as the killing of an adult, for example, would be. And as he points out towards the end of this section that I've highlighted, there eventually emerges in the Middle Ages a two-tier system. And here it's not just a question of the penances that are assigned, but how one deals with them. There were private penances that you could be given by your priest confessor, but there were certain sins that required public canonical penalties. And although this is varied during this period, this will gradually evolve into the notion of sins which can be forgiven by a priest and other sins that are reserved either to the local bishop or, in extreme cases, to the Holy See. That isn't as clearly articulated during this period, but one sees the beginnings of what would become that more formal practice later. And he marks, and I've highlighted these as numbers 1, 2, and 3, that there were three different positions that one can find scattered in these various documents. One, a conviction that abortion was homicide, whatever the stage of pregnancy. And remember, we're talking about induced abortion. We're not talking specifically about the question of a mother whose infant can't be delivered. This is someone who is deliberately taking a drug or engaging in an action in order to destroy the life of a developing child. The first opinion was that abortion was always homicide. The second, that abortion was homicide only after formation or ensoulment, and it was varied as to what this meant, when this was expected to happen, whether it had to do with some notion of the appearance of the developing embryo or fetus, or a theory of animation, or maybe even a tradition of quickening when the woman first feels movement. But there would be a distinction between earlier and later abortion on some rather arbitrary criterion, before which it was not homicide in the formal sense, but was still a very serious sin. And the third approach was that abortion was homicide, and so was contraception. And as we've seen, there would have been regarded precedent for this in some of the church fathers. And one can find documents during this period illustrating all three points of view. And the first document, number 3.2, that I've given you, is a text from the Council of Ankara. This is not an ecumenical council. It precedes the tradition of ecumenical councils beginning with Nicaea in 325, but it is a gathering of bishops attempting to articulate what they regard as appropriate legislation for the people of God in a period just before Christianity became the established religion. And this is a canon to which later documents would look back, to which they would refer as having significant weight. And here it describes women who commit fornication and then destroy what they have conceived, a woman who is deliberately attempting to induce abortion to hide her pregnancy, or who compounds drugs to cause abortion, that is, the person who supplies the agents that are supposed to do that. The council notes that there was an ancient decree, where this is coming from we're not quite sure, that suggested that there was a penance that was to be endured until the end of their lives. And we also saw this in Basel, an older tradition that the penalty for abortion was excommunication for life, and one could only be reconciled to the church on one's deathbed. However, this council in the early 4th century says, in a spirit of greater leniency, we decree that they must complete 10 years of penance. So a 10-year penitential period was assigned, and that's a basis or a tradition to which a later documents would refer. Number 3.3, this is from a homily. It's from a sermon by St. Caesarius of Arles, a bishop in what is now France, in the middle, approximately, of the 6th century, the early to middle part of the 6th century. And he is speaking to his people. He's speaking generally to the people he's caring for. No woman should ever take drugs to induce abortion or kill the children she has conceived or born. So he's preaching against abortion and against infanticide. And he also says women should not take diabolical potions for the purpose of becoming unable to conceive children. And he says that this act of contraception, or effectively rendering oneself sterile, means that one is guilty of as many homicides as the number of children she may have borne. So St. Caesarius is taking a very strict approach to the question not only of abortion and infanticide, but also of contraception, claiming that it is a kind of a moral equivalent of homicide. The next text, number 3-4, represents the law that became common as a result of the Germanic tribes that initially were given responsibility for various parts of the empire by the Eastern Roman Emperor, and who then settled in, converted to Christianity, sometimes initially to Arian Christianity, and who had their own traditions, their very strict and sometimes brutal traditions of law. And in their legal collections, one finds two different approaches to the question of abortion, two different approaches in the same document. One of them is what is to be done if someone causes a free woman to abort, and again a reminder that justice was meted out differently if one was free or if one was a slave. And here, too, one finds a different fine if you have destroyed a formed infant. Si firmatum infantem. If he has destroyed a formed infant, there is a fine of 150 solidi, and if it's an unformed, infirmem infant, it's 100 solidi. This is, again, a reminder that there is this distinction, even in cultures which are rather more based on rendering a form of retribution. This is not an ecclesiastical document, but again, a matter of public, or, if you will, civil law. And in the same document, a little further on, there is a much stricter document that if a free woman or female slave murders a son or daughter which has been born, that is infanticide, or performs an abortion while having it still in utero, takes a portion or by potion or by any other means destroys her own fetus, the response to this is she merits death. Or if the judge wishes to be merciful, another penalty such as blinding might be applied, and not only to the woman but to her husband if her husband approved of or required that this be done. So these rather brutal collections of law are reminders of how things were viewed in the Christianizing Roman Empire outside the immediately ecclesiastical context. And the last of these documents I'd like us to look at from the penitential tradition is that of Theodore of Canterbury, number 3.5. And here we see that in this penitential, this document intended to guide confessors, here too, there is a tradition of leniency, and also a variation depending upon the stage of gestation. Women who commit abortion, this is number 24, before the fetus has life, do penance for 1 year or for the 3 40-day periods, that is to say the fasting periods of Lent and of Advent and of the pre-Advent Lenten fast, which existed in the Western tradition of the early Middle Ages and still exists in the Christian East today. And if later, that is if it's more than 40 days after conception, so here's a limit of 40 days that's applied, then the penance applies to them as if they had committed homicide. And that's, of course, a greater penance. And then if you drop down to number 27, a woman who conceives and slays her child in the womb within 40 days does penance for a year, but if later than 40 days, does penance as a murderess, a kind of a reiteration of what had been seen in number 24. And again, a reminder, these penitentials were intended to guide confessors. They represent a stage in the development of doctrine on this subject. They are not in any sense definitive reflections of teaching of the magisterium, but they do give us an idea of how the debate would be framed when it came to be discussed by more significant and important theologians, such as St. Thomas Aquinas, to whom we will now turn.